So far we've looked at four reasons why I believe in Jesus Christ. They are because of the Old Testament, because of his birth, because of his life, and because of his miracles. And there are three more reasons, and obviously we're not going to cover three in 45 minutes. So I'm just going to tell you what two of them are. One I'll make a few comments about, the other one hardly any. Number five is because of his death. And his death was amazing from many, many points of view, not the least from the legal standpoint, looked at from the Jewish legal background. It was completely contrary to many points of Jewish law. If somebody was going to be condemned to death, there should be two trials separated by at least a week. But he was arrested one day and crucified the next. There were witnesses who were bribed, and they couldn't agree. He was compelled to testify against himself, which is illegal, although he did it quite voluntarily. Then the charge was changed. He was condemned by the Jews for blasphemy, handed over to the Romans on the charge of political sedition, and was sentenced by the Romans with political charge in that he claimed to be king. Pilate could find nothing wrong with him, declared him to be innocent, but still allowed himself to be pressured into proclaiming the death sentence. And a crowd condemned a completely innocent man and released a murderer rather than the Prince of Life. Very amazing circumstances about his death. Normally, death by crucifixion would take 4 days, 3 to 4 days. The nail was placed somewhere around here. It was not through the hand. A nail through the hand would pull out very easily from between the fingers and would not hold the body for very long. It was placed very carefully by the Romans between the two large bones and missing the arteries. There would be very little blood loss, and the arm would be held very rigidly and very firmly. Very similarly, the nail put through the feet. Extremely painful, but none of them were fatal wounds. There would be very little loss of blood, and usually the life very, very slowly ebbed away over a period of 3 to 4 days, in which there would be periods of unconsciousness. It was extremely painful and humiliating. Most of the joints, most of the bones were dislocated as the muscles began to writhe and contract as they rebelled against being held in such a rigid position, and the bones all became dislocated. Then it wasn't too sure, wasn't too clear after 3 days or so whether they were alive or dead. Couldn't be very sure. And the Romans had devised ways of testing whether or not you were alive or dead. But Jesus, after only 3 hours, gave a loud shout. It was very difficult to even talk when you were crucified, because as the weight hung down here, the throat was constricted by the configuration of the body, and the weight hanging down here, and even to breathe was extremely difficult. To speak, you had to raise yourself to clear the tubes, and to shout, extraordinarily difficult. And you still had to have a lot of vitality to be able to do that. And yet with just about his last breath, he gave a loud shout, "It is finished." And then he dismissed the spirit. King James translates it, "gave up the ghost." But literally, he dismissed his spirit. He said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." And one moment he was alive, he was conscious, he was aware of things, he was speaking. The next moment, he'd gone. The centurion in charge of the crucifixion had no doubt seen thousands of people die by crucifixion. It was very common. And yet he had never seen anything like this. And he was so impressed by the behavior of Christ during the flogging and the time on the cross, that from that very hard-bitten, very rough Roman soldier, there was wrung the confession, surely this was the Son of God. And for him to say that at the scene of the crucifixion meant that he himself really was risking death. He could be crucified just for saying that. I don't believe he was, but it wasn't something that he said very lightly. And while it may be relatively simple to act during a lifetime, although I think it would be difficult to convince people that you were God, even if you can keep up a performance during your lifetime, it's rather difficult to act when you're being crucified. You're real then. And yet, the reality of what the Roman centurion saw in Christ as he died on the cross convinced him, not just that he was a great man, but that he was the Son of God. Also, Jesus himself was not in despair. He didn't curse or threaten. He submitted himself to the Father and he dismissed the Spirit. The Romans were very surprised to find that he was already dead. The two thieves were not dead. They broke the legs of the thieves, which was a normal way of accelerating death. It was a pity to accelerate it, because it was supposed to be a long, slow, lingering death, and it was designed as such. But they had to get them off the cross that night, because the next day was the Sabbath. And one way of hastening the death, but not making it too quick and adding a little suffering to it as a compensation for shortening the time, was to break their legs. So they did that to the two thieves. They didn't do that to Jesus. They tested him for death with a spear, and we'll think about that later. But that was the way he died. And the way he died is extremely convincing that he was what he claimed to be. Especially when you see in what great detail it fulfilled the Old Testament prophecies. Particularly Psalm 22, where it was predicted that they would cast lots for his clothes. Of his robe, rather, and share out his clothing among them. And the Roman soldiers did that, literally, right underneath the cross, in fulfillment of Psalm 22, which is a detailed description of crucifixion, written about the year 900, 200 years before crucifixion was introduced. It was introduced by the Phoenicians, and later picked up by the Romans, but Psalm 22 is written probably 200 years before anybody was crucified. And yet it talks about the dislocation of the bones, it talks about the piercing of the hands and feet, it talks about them sharing out the clothes and throwing dice for the vesture. All that fulfilled right there at the cross. So that would be reason number five. Reason number seven is the experience of the Christian church. In other words, every single person who has genuinely known Jesus Christ, who has trusted him and proved that he does what he says he will do, give you a new birth, come live in you, transform your life, etc. Everyone who genuinely knows Jesus Christ is living proof that he is what he claims to be. So that's reason number seven. It's 2,000 years of church history, which includes your own experience of him. And that would be a very large lecture if we were to go into 2,000 years of Christian experience of a living Jesus. We'll find out about it when we get to heaven, but you know enough to share from your own context. So that's number seven. Number six, the one we're going to look at tonight, is the resurrection. This is probably the strongest single arguing ground if you really want to argue about Jesus being the Son of God. And I don't recommend that you do argue too much, because arguments don't usually win people. You can win the argument and still lose the person. It is good for you to be convinced. It is good for you to be able to answer people's questions if they're genuine questions and they want to know. It's not necessarily helpful for you just to win arguments. But as we look at the resurrection, we might think of it in terms of a sort of court case where you could decide, is there enough evidence as to whether or not Jesus did rise from the dead? There have been various noteworthy skeptics, atheists, etc., a great many of them Frenchmen, And there was a quite famous one time, decided he would found a new religion just to prove that anybody could found a religion, nothing special about Jesus Christ. And this was the French writer Molière. And after about 4 years of trying very hard to get a new religion off the ground, he wasn't doing very well, and he talked to a friend who was a Christian. He said, "What do you think I ought to do?" And the Christian said, "Well, probably the best thing you could do would be to let us crucify you, and then you'd come back to life again 3 days later, and then maybe we'd believe in you." Only Molière didn't seem to think he quite knew the trick. So he didn't want to do that. The fact that Jesus did rise from the dead, and that he said that he would before he did it, is very, very strong indeed. And there's a great deal of evidence to say that he did rise from the dead. We're going to look at it. And when you're in a court of law, there are two kinds of evidence. There is what's called direct evidence, and then there is another kind of evidence which is called circumstantial evidence. Please turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Now, the difference between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence is a bit like this. Suppose you've got a millionaire who lives in a state in the United States where there is a death penalty, and the millionaire is murdered, and his only relatives are two sons, brothers. And suppose the younger son says, "I saw my brother shoot my father." Then that would be direct evidence, eyewitness testimony. "I saw my brother shoot my father." Direct evidence is like that. Do we have any direct evidence that Jesus rose from the dead? 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3. "For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Peter and then to the 12. After that he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have died. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all he appeared to me also, as to one abnormally born." So do we have any direct evidence? Yes, we do. We have a man called Paul who says, "He appeared to me. I saw him." When somebody claims to be a witness at an event like this, there are usually three factors that will either strengthen or weaken the dependence that you will place upon his evidence. They are his intellectual competence, his moral reliability, and whether or not he has a vested interest. What do we mean by that? Is the man of sufficient intellectual stature to really know what he's talking about? If your witness is a village idiot, you've got a question mark against him. If he's giving evidence about some very technical subject in which he's not qualified, you have a doubt about him. But about this, there can be very little doubt. Paul is one of the great brains of his time. He has real intellectual stature, and he's talking about something in which he was very well qualified. And he says, "I saw Christ, Jesus Christ, risen from the dead." And there is no doubting his intellectual competence. How about his moral reliability? See, if the man who's giving evidence is known to be the world's greatest con man, then you don't necessarily believe him when he gives evidence in a court of law. But behind Paul's testimony there stands his character, which is an extremely dependable character. He was a Pharisee. He observed the law better than anybody else of his own generation. Morally speaking, he was a giant amongst men. He was the kind of man that's very difficult to discredit, very difficult to disbelieve. So again, behind his statement that he saw the living Christ, there is the weight of his moral character. The third thing, is there a vested interest? Let's go back to our murdered millionaire. If the millionaire has been murdered, the younger brother says, I saw my older brother do it, is there any reason that he might have for saying that if it was not true? And yes, there is. Because if both boys are alive, then the millions will be divided between the two of them. But if the older brother is guilty of murder and he's executed, then the younger brother will inherit the whole lot. So it is possible that he would say he saw his older brother murder his father because he stands to gain a considerable amount of money by doing so. In other words, while it may not be the case, he might be lying because it is to his advantage to do so. Now, is it to Paul's advantage to say that he saw Christ risen from the dead if he didn't? Why would Paul say, I saw Jesus alive from the dead, if he never did do it? What did he get out of it? Well, he was disowned by his own family. He was hated by his own people. On one occasion, 40 of them swore never to eat again till they killed him. He could write a tourist guide to most of the prisons of Europe from the inside. He tells us in 2 Corinthians 11 about some of his experiences as a Christian. He says, I worked harder than the other people did. I've been in prison more often. I've been flogged more severely and been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with iron rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spend a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from the heathen, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled and often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and often gone without food. I have been cold and naked, and beside all this I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. Not only does Paul not have a reason to say that he saw Jesus alive from the dead if he didn't, he has every reason not to say so. All he got in reward, material terms, for saying that he was a witness to the living Christ was beatings, imprisonments, flogging, stoning, hunger, thirst, poverty, and unpopularity. Paul had every reason not to say that he'd seen Jesus arise from the dead, and yet he insists on going everywhere and telling people that he has seen him and that he is alive. So Paul, as a witness, has enormous stature. He's intellectually competent, he's morally reliable, and it is costing him a great deal to give that evidence, and he's gaining nothing if it's not true. Now, one person's evidence is never enough. Do we have anybody else to substantiate it? Yes, we've got the evidence of Peter. Peter, on the day of Pentecost, stands in Jerusalem, preaches the first ever Christian sermon, and he talks about the Jews having crucified Jesus, but then he says, this Jesus whom you crucified, God has raised up, and we are witnesses. Now Peter, when compared to Paul, is not of the same intellectual stature as Paul, but he's got enough common sense to know whether the person he saw was alive or dead. And he's got enough intelligence to recognize whether it was Jesus or not. He'd known him for 3 years and ought to be able to recognize him. In addition to which, of course, he saw the holes in his hands, etc. So, do we have somebody else? Yes, we've got Peter. Is he intellectually competent? Yes. He's not an intellectual giant like Paul, but he's competent. Is he morally reliable? Again, he's not quite the same stature as Paul, but he's reasonably reliable. He believed it strongly enough to be crucified. Again, did he have a vested interest? No. What did he get out of it? Suffering and crucifixion. So now we've got two people, and that is enough. If you've got two eyewitnesses and their stories tally, that is enough to seal the case. So you've got Peter and Paul. Do we have any more? Yes, according to 1 Corinthians 15 here, more than 500 who all saw him at the same time. That's a powerful body of evidence. He's seen by all the apostles, and he appeared to them many times over a period of 40 days. Some people would argue on the basis of an illusion, but never in the history of medicine have two people had the same illusion. Still less of 500 had it at the same time. So we've got to rule out any kind of illusion or anything like this. This was not something self-induced. It was a reality that these people saw. Okay, having looked at the direct evidence, is there any indirect evidence? What is indirect evidence? What we call circumstantial evidence. What would the circumstantial evidence be in terms of our murdered millionaire? The younger brother says, I saw my older brother shoot him. That is direct evidence. Here's a circumstantial evidence. The older brother and father were heard to have a serious argument the day of the murder. The father was found shot, the bullet traceable to a gun that belonged to the older brother. The older brother's fingerprints are found upon the gun, and none other. That would all be circumstantial evidence. Is there any circumstantial evidence that Jesus rose from the dead? On the Sunday morning of Easter, Peter and John headed for the tomb together. Jesus had been buried there, and this is how he was buried. He'd first been crucified, and he'd been wrapped up in a winding sheet, which is wound up from the feet all the way up to the neck, and then a separate piece is wound around the head. Within the folds of the bandages, there was 100 pounds weight of spices and ointments put there by Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea. There was a large stone mounted, big rock mounted over the mouth of the tomb that three women knew that they couldn't move between them. In those days, women were tough. See, they had muscles and hairy legs and things. But three of them knew that between them they couldn't move that big rock. It was sealed in position with a Roman seal. There were 16 soldiers mounted on guard, 16 Roman soldiers, and Roman soldiers took their guard duty fairly seriously. If one of them slept on duty, they cut off his head, stuck it outside the guard room on top of a spear as a suggestion to the other guards that they didn't sleep. And it was a fairly effective suggestion on the whole. So there were 16 guards mounted to protect the tomb of Jesus, make sure no one tampered with it. Peter and John came to the tomb, Peter went in first, then John went in, and what he saw convinced him not that the body had been taken away, but that Jesus was risen. Because what he saw was the winding sheet still wound round and round and round with all the spices in it, as though the body was still inside, except that it had fallen in on itself because the body wasn't there. And a tiny space, and then the one that was around the head. And the body had passed through them without disturbing them. That's how John was convinced, not that the body had been taken away, but that Christ had risen from the dead. He was the first one to believe that. But as the resurrection was preached, it was preached within sight of the tomb. And if it was a lie, they would have preached it somewhere else. If there was still a corpse inside the tomb, it would have been a rather silly thing to do. It was not a popular message. It was not popular with the Jewish authorities. It was not popular with the Roman authorities. If they were declaring that Jesus was alive when his body was still in the tomb, all they had to do was bring it out and say, "Oh, what's this then?" And nobody would have believed the resurrection. They were not able to produce the corpse because it wasn't there. If it wasn't there, where was it? If the Romans or Jews had removed it, they could still produce it. But they couldn't produce it because they hadn't removed it. The disciples were terrified. It wasn't likely that the disciples were going to take on 16 Roman soldiers and steal the body. They were scattered in terror. If they did steal the body, what did they steal it for? Why did they say he was risen from the dead if he wasn't, if all they got out of it was crucifixion? 10 out of the 11 of them died violently and the other one in exile. They didn't make money out of it. Why would they do that? How would they do that? The best story the Romans could come up with, or the Jews could come up with, was that the disciples stole the body while the guard slept, and the guard were said told to say that. But if they slept, how did they know who stole the body? Then there's the change in the behavior and the attitude of the disciples. The disciples somehow were not expecting the resurrection. They didn't believe it all that readily. When Jesus appeared on the Easter Sunday night, he appeared to 10 disciples. 2 were missing. Thomas was missing, and Judas was missing. Judas had a reasonable excuse. He was dead. But we don't know why Thomas missed it. But he did. But sometime later, Thomas met with the other disciples. And maybe you can imagine how that was. "Hi, Thomas, how you doing? How's the wife?" "Oh, really? You see the game on TV last night? It was good, wasn't it?" Something I was going to tell you, Thomas, just slipped my mind now. Something I thought you could have been interested in." "Oh yeah, I remember what it was. Jesus was here." "Do you think it was like that?" "Somehow I don't think it was quite like that." "Hey, Thomas, man, have you missed it? Do you know who was here last night? Jesus was here." "What are you talking about?" "Told you, Jesus was here." "No, he wasn't. He's dead." "He was dead, Thomas, but he's alive again." "When you die, you die. That's it. Everybody knows that." "But Thomas, Jesus is alive again. He was here and we all saw him." "Don't give me that stuff. It was nice while he lasted. But he's dead now. Forget it. It's over." "But Thomas, he was here. We talked with him. We saw the holes in his hands. And he ate with us. And it's Jesus, and he's alive, and we all saw him, didn't we, guys?" "Yeah, we all saw him, Thomas." look, when you're dead, you are dead, right? Late, deceased, extinct, finished. He is dead. Don't waste your breath. You can talk till you're black in your face, and I won't believe you. Because when you're dead, that's it. And there was a time when I thought Thomas was absolutely unreal. Surely, if my 10 best friends all told me the same thing, and they're all excited about it and convinced about it, surely I'd believe them. Wouldn't you if your 10 best friends told you the same thing? But I have 3 children. See? If you want to be a preacher, you have to have children, otherwise you can't tell stories about them. See? So, it's the first thing, if you want to be a preacher. And when my children were quite young, I decided to do an experiment on them. And they were, I think, at this time, I think they were 3, 4, and 5, about that anyway. And they'd been, most of their time till then, South America. And lots of things they'd not experienced. And I got my daughter to draw me on a piece of cardboard a nice little road. And I produced a little plastic car that was just a shell with wheels on it, nothing inside it, about an inch long. I showed it to them. And I said, you know, that little car can start at the bottom of that road, climb all the way up, round all the bends, right up to the top, without anybody touching it. And they all looked at me with a very sad expression, as though to say, poor old Dad. We always knew that one day it would become too much for him, and now it's happened. Isn't it sad? I said, you don't believe me, do you? And they said, no. So I said, all right, Joanna and Paul, you go out, Andrew, you stay in here. Andrew being the youngest and very excitable. So Andrew Watts, that little car went up the road, round all the bends, right up to the top. Nobody touched it. And Andrew got all excited about it. And I called the other two back in, and I said, Andrew, what did you see? And he said, It did exactly what Daddy said it would do. It went all the way around the road and right to the top. And Daddy didn't touch it, and I didn't touch it. And I looked at the other two, and I said, well. And they said, it didn't. So I said to Paul, look, your own brother Andrew just told you that he saw it. He's a baby. Okay, you stay in. Joanna, out again. So Joanna went out, and Paul stayed in, and Paul watched. And when you're 4, of course, you're a lot more dignified than when you're mere 3. And so you don't dance around and get excited. In any case, Paul's a different temperament. But he watched with big round eyes and the mouth open as this little car went all the way up the road, right up to the top, and nobody touched it. And I called Joanna back in, and I said, Paul, what did you see? And he said, it did. It did, Joanna. All the way. And nobody touched it. So I looked at Joanna, and I said, well, she said it didn't. And I said, but your own brother Andrew told you that he saw it. He's a baby. Well, your own brother Paul told you he saw it. He's a lion. So I said, suppose I tell you I saw it. You won't say anything then. You still don't believe it, though, do you? She said, no. So then I produced it again, a little piece of blue tack, a little metal dish, stuck it on there, magnet, showed them the magnet. They'd never seen one before. Then I put it on the card, put the magnet on the back of the card, and I did it again. And I said, do you believe it now? She said, of course I do. So I said, but you didn't before. And she said, no. Well, why didn't you? When I told you I'd seen it, Paul told you he'd seen it, and Andrew told you he'd seen it. And she said, I don't know, but I didn't. And this is exactly Thomas. And I said to Joanna, do you think it's because you couldn't understand how it could happen? And she said, yes, I really didn't believe it could. I didn't see how it could, so I didn't believe you when you said you'd seen it. And that's just what Thomas was. He didn't understand how a dead body could rise from the dead, so he wasn't about to believe it, even though his 10 best friends all told him they'd seen it happen. And there is a change in Thomas because Jesus appeared to him, showed him the holes in his hand, and said, Thomas, put your finger in. And Thomas said, my Lord and my God. And Thomas was convinced. Thomas wasn't a simpleton, he wasn't gullible, wasn't a fool, wasn't quick to believe, but he was convinced. And the change in Thomas, and the change in the disciples who were terrified when Jesus was arrested, suddenly became bold, and only 2 months after the crucifixion, declared the resurrection in the same city where he'd been crucified. And Peter was arrested, and the authorities said, listen, we crucified your master, we can do the same for you anytime. And Peter smiled at them and said, well, whether it's right to obey you or to obey God, you'll have to decide, won't you? One of the most convincing things for me, though, is the complete lack in 2,000 years of destructive criticism and research, the complete lack of any reasonable alternative theory. The most believable theory that's ever been put forward, which denies the resurrection, is this one, that Jesus didn't actually die. That what happened was he fainted while he was on the cross. And in the cool of the tomb, he revived. And the disciples thought so much of him anyway, and they were so delighted when he appeared to them again, that they thought that he had risen from the dead. That is the most believable alternative theory. It has one or two small snags, but it's the most believable alternative theory. Here are the snags. Number one, the Romans knew how to test for death. They were surprised that he was dead, and they tested him to make sure. What they did was that they stuck the spear into his stomach. And when they did that, there appeared a clear liquid and blood. It's described as water and blood. It's not water and blood. It's a clear liquid and blood that do not mix. Water and blood mix together and it just looks like blood. The clear liquid is called pericardiac fluid. It surrounds the heart, and they are sacs that cushion the heart. It doesn't mix with water or with blood. But when the membranes of the heart burst, that liquid drains down into the stomach along with large quantities of blood. And when they stuck the spear into the stomach, and not up here but into the stomach, the pericardiac liquid flowed out clear, not mixed with the blood, and it was evidence to the Romans that he was genuinely dead. And it would be very substantial medical evidence today. So the first thing you have to believe is that the Romans, who are experts in these things, were mistaken about death. Now, while there was not a great deal of loss of blood through the nail wounds, there was a fair bit from the flogging from his back, and a great deal through the wound, the spear thrust into his stomach. In addition to that, crucifixion dislocates the bones, as we've already said. Now, we've got to believe that Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus took his body down off the cross and didn't happen to notice that it was still alive. Then they wound it up with a winding sheet from the feet all the way up to the neck and still didn't notice that he was alive. And then they bound up his head with another one, which would cut off his breathing, but somehow he survived it. Then they buried him in a tomb with 100 pounds weight, and 100 pounds a lot, a really substantial backpack such as I took climbing in BC a year or two ago was 70 pounds. There's food for 10 days, two-man tent, and all the clothing that we needed, sleeping bag, etc., mattress, everything for 10 days, 70 pounds. This was 100 pounds. So you've got a body with a considerable blood loss that can't breathe, with all the bones dislocated and 100 pounds weight put on top of it, and somehow or other that clever body wriggles out from the grave clothes and leaves them as though it was still inside them. Having done that, it approaches a large stone that three women knew they couldn't move between them, and rolls it out of the way, and terrifies the Roman guard that run away in terror. Then appears so healthy and vigorous that the disciples are convinced that he's risen from the dead, and nobody suggests when they see him that they ought to get a doctor or give him any medical attention. Having done that, he allows them, because he's a sufficient moral character to do so, he allows them to believe he's risen from the dead when he knows perfectly well he never did die. And then he has this clever trick of drifting up into the air and disappearing into a cloud and never coming back again. It takes a lot of faith to believe that. That is the best explanation, the best alternative explanation that skeptical minds have been able to come up with in 2,000 years of destructive research. What fits the facts very much better is a simple declaration that he rose from the dead. Why do I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? I believe it because for 1,500 years the Old Testament, that amazing book, told that he was coming and described exactly how he would be. Why do I believe in Jesus Christ? Because everybody that was concerned with his birth, his mother, his father, King Herod, and all kinds of other people, including the angels, point him out as being the Son of God. Why do I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Because the life he lived was absolutely without parallel. Moral caliber, incredible teachings, and the impact that he made on all the people of his time, who from enemies to friends to demon-possessed people all say the same thing. He's divine. Why do I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Because the miracles that he did are absolutely consistent with the miracles in nature, and the people who were there and experienced those miracles wrote about them, and that is evidence. The people who drank the wine at the wedding, the people who first of all got the 5 rolls and 2 sardines and then collected up the 12 baskets full, they wrote about it, that's evidence. They were there. The people who saw the leper healed, they wrote about it, that's evidence. They were present. I wasn't, but they were there, and that's what they say happened. I believe in him because of miracles he did. I believe in him because of his behavior throughout the trial and crucifixion. I believe in him because he rose from the dead, and I believe in him because for 2,000 years the church has proved that he's alive and in business. And he has proved it in my life over a period now of very nearly 30 years. So let's pray together. Father, thank you for Jesus. Thank you that the case is just so strong. We can build with confidence on this foundation. He really is the Son of God. It's not just a nice idea. It's true. It's rock solid faith. But Lord, it's not enough just to know in our hearts that he's Son of God unless we bring to him that faith and that worship which he deserves and which he demands. Lord Jesus, I thank you for revealing yourself to me. I thank you for making me sure as to who you are. But being sure of who you are means that I must treat you as you deserve. So I bring to you tonight my obedience, the sacrifice of my future, my body, mind, ambitions, dreams, my time, talents and possessions. All belongs to you, Lord. You are my Lord and my God. Amen.